Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Picture yourself on a beach, retired early and enjoying financial freedom. If this is your dream, then now's the time to level up your investing game, and Real Vision can help you. We arm you with the knowledge, the tools, and the network to succeed on your financial journey on your own terms. Take control of your future and visit realvision.com/free. That's realvision.com/free.
Are crypto markets at risk? Welcome to Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Wednesday, May 8, 2024. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by Jeff Dorman, Chief Investment Officer and co-founder at Arca. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, Jeff. I have to say, just right at the outset, I've really enjoyed your writing recently on That's Our Two Satoshis, talking about what's happening in crypto markets. You managed to do something that is very difficult to do, which is to take all the data points, all the news flow, which is coming fast and thick right now, and arrange it into a narrative that makes some coherent sense. Really appreciate your work. Talk a little bit, Jeff, about where you see us right now in crypto markets.
Sure. Well, first of all, I appreciate that. Look, I'm as constructive as ever on the crypto markets. I don't think anything has changed there. Probably the biggest change versus expectations, at least in crypto, was just slower than expected inflows into the industry outside of Bitcoin. Typically when you see the type of return set that we saw in 2023 and thus far in early 2024, you see a lot more money coming in. I think maybe underestimated either how badly burned some investors were by 2022 and or just how difficult it is to push allocations through an investment committee or through a board. But within the walls of the digital asset industry, there's really nothing not to be excited about right now. Sorry for the double negative there, but really it's exciting, right? I mean, we're seeing a similar setup to what we saw 3 or 4 years ago, which is real projects emerging, real and new sectors emerging, right? Similar to 2020, 21, when all of a sudden we had DeFi and stablecoins and NFTs. You know, now you've got real world assets, and you've got Bitcoin layer twos and ordinals and runes popping up. You've got AI and gaming. So it's a really nice setup, not to mention the macro setup. So pretty exciting. I think the big challenge, as always, is just the narrative, right? Can we separate what's actually happening from all of the noise and the fluff that's out there trying to either confuse or distract from what's really happening?
It sounds like you're really quite optimistic, quite constructive on the underlying innovation that's happening in this space right now. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, look, I think this is an asset class that may actually not even be an asset class anymore. And I say that purposely because I often make comparisons to the ETF market, right? You would very rarely, if ever, find someone who would say, I can't invest in ETFs right now because I don't believe in that asset class. People would be like, well, what are you talking about, right? Are you talking about the, commodities part of ETFs or the equity part of ETFs or fixed income or actively managed ETFs? Like, what does that mean, right? It's very easy for people to compartmentalize that the ETF is a wrapper or a structure and lots of different things fit into it. 10 years ago, and even as much as 7 years ago, the crypto and blockchain world really was just sort of currencies, right? And that's all anybody thought about. But now it's everything. You've got currencies, you've got commodity-like assets, you've got asset backs and equity and bond-like assets. You've got meme coin, you've got all these different sectors from gaming and AI and all the things I mentioned earlier, DeFi. It's really hard to just put crypto in a box. And yet that's constantly what is being done. It's constantly crypto is uninvestable or crypto is a great asset class or you have to be involved or you can't be involved. And it just doesn't make any sense. There's parts of crypto that make all the sense in the world. There's parts that don't, but it's just grown tremendously. And in terms of your question about what's exciting, like, yeah, there are parts of the industry that are really growing. I mean, stablecoin growth is incredibly impressive. You know, the ability to have all these different chains now supporting DeFi applications in layer twos is really impressive. The amount of games that are going to be launched in 2024 and into 2025 that have been worked on for 3 or 4 years is really an impressive suite. And it's probably going to be the next on-ramp into real consumer adoption. Some of the DPIN applications, even if maybe price of the token in some cases is ahead of the fundamentals of the project, these are real projects touching real people where a lot of the end consumer doesn't even know it's being run on a crypto rail. So that development is real. And again, it's really hard to look at like Bitcoin and DPIN and gaming and put them in the same bucket. They aren't, right? In the same way that, you know, you wouldn't bring a long short equity manager on to talk about gold. You know, you shouldn't bring on somebody who's focused on different niche sectors of crypto and have them just talk about Bitcoin. It just doesn't make sense. They're totally different, just happen to be packaged in the same wrapper.
Yeah, that's really interesting talking about this. That's a significant conceptual shift, I think, from the way a lot of people perceive it, which is, as you say, as an asset class. But essentially what you're saying is, what if this is a more of a technology-driven revolution where you start to see all of the existing traditional capital market structures moving on to digital asset decentralized rails, probably plus new applications that don't work or don't make sense under traditional capital market structures? A really interesting concept.
Yeah, and in fact, I even purposely don't use the word revolution and instead use the word evolution for that reason. It's not necessarily that we're recreating or that we're creating anything new. A lot of cases, we're just repackaging or recreating it in a way that just makes more sense, right? It's a natural evolution of finance. It's a natural evolution of gaming. It's a natural evolution of payments and as the way to think about asset transfer and collectibles. So to me, it's more evolutionary than revolutionary.
Interesting. I want to shift gears here a little bit and talk about maybe if we were thinking about our digital assets, crypto in a different context, more of a as currently just a risk on asset or a super asset class. I wanted to take a look at a clip to just talk a little bit and set up a little bit of the broader macro context right now. This is from a conversation that actually I had with Tanya Reif, Martin Leibwender, and Brian Dixon. Let's take a look at this clip real quick and then we'll get your reaction to it.
First, we had geopolitical tensions. That's always problematic for asset markets. We had the Iran-Israel debacle happening early in the month, somewhat mid-month, first from the Iranian side, then from the Israeli side. All the uncertainty that that brought to the markets was not good for asset prices, but in particular also it pushed oil prices higher. And we have had three consecutive months where inflation had surprised to the upside, pushing rates higher. And then on top of that, geopolitical tensions are pushing oil prices higher, and that's adding to the pressure on rates. So we had the geopolitical tensions adding up to oil prices and a rate outlook that was making markets very nervous. Higher rates are, of course, not great for liquidity. And as we know, for crypto assets, liquidity is of paramount importance. So then, again, on the liquidity side, outside the rates outlook, we also had a little bit of an air pocket in liquidity, like Michael Howell likes to call it. And the reason is we had a pullback in the US because people were paying their taxes. So the TGA actually rose mid-month by April 15, which was a tax deadline, and that pulled liquidity out of the system. And on top of that, we had other central banks, most importantly, China, that had also pulled back on their liquidity injections for the month. So you had, if you will, a combination of a perfect storm between the tensions, the rate outlooks, and the liquidity cycle all coming together.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You've heard the headlines. Inflation is unchecked. The dollar is collapsing. The government is printing too much money. Well, the fear may be real, but there is a solution. Gold. Gold isn't collapsing, and gold's value increases during inflationary times. Noble Gold Investments is here to help you protect your wealth. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They have secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Whether you're a seasoned investor or new to the game, Noble Gold Investments simplifies and secures your gold investment journey. You see, unlike money, the government can't just print more gold. It's your shield in times of economic uncertainty. And gold remains steady when inflation is on the rise and the dollar is in turmoil. So, invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. Don't wait. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision.
Well, there you see, Tanya, I've coming at this from more of a sort of cyclical perspective rather than the broader secular structural context that we were talking about. But she mentions a couple of things in terms of global macro headwinds. First, geopolitical tensions, the impact and risk to oil prices and potential rate outlook, the air pocket in liquidity, and also China pulling back on their liquidity. Jeff, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. And I think, you know, I've been one of the advocates of crypto's uncorrelation or non-correlation to traditional assets and macro over the last decade. And of course, 2022 threw that for a loop because everything went to correlation one, basically because you had a 4 or 5 sigma, a change in terms of rate expectations and rate hikes. We went into 2022 expecting 3 cuts of 75 basis points total. And of course, ended up with what, almost 400 basis points or over 400 basis points of hikes instead of just 3 and 75. So when you had that kind of a move, everything went correlation one. You also had obviously the bankruptcies that infected it in crypto. So you started to build this narrative that, hey, crypto is just sort of a risk on asset class and it's going to get hit just like anything else. And it's just not true, right? The data over 7 or 10 years or even 3 years shows that this is a pretty uncorrelated asset class. So while we look at these macro factors and they certainly can matter at times, they don't always matter. And specifically with what was mentioned in that clip, you know, the Israel-Iran conflict was really interesting because the initial knee-jerk reaction on the very first Iran headline, Bitcoin actually went higher with gold. And then on every subsequent headline, it started going down and ultimately led to liquidations and cascades and led to momentum traders and pushing everything down. And it's hard for me to say in a vacuum, if there was weren't other factors going on, that that alone was going to be negative for crypto. In fact, you know, there's no real historical evidence that wars in general are really have any sort of long-lasting effect on equity markets or crypto markets. Certainly, there's no empirical data that suggests that oil prices have any real effect on crypto prices. But what I will say is that the liquidity is real, right? When you have periods of increased liquidity, global liquidity, that is obviously good for all risk assets because it increases the flow of money. It increases the riskiness of sitting on cash and the opportunity cost of sitting on cash. And it does for sure affect markets. What I would point out specifically, though, to the Israel-Iran conflict is that there were a lot of other factors going on that, in my opinion, were by themselves not necessarily impactful enough to push the digital asset market down, but collectively were enough. And the Israel-Iran conflict was really just a trigger that pushed selling to a level that created everyone paying attention to these other things. For example, the higher than anticipated inflation prints in April, which resulted in a reduction of the expected Fed rate cuts this year, a slowdown in the Bitcoin ETF inflows, the assumed rejection of the upcoming May Ethereum spot ETF, Uniswap receiving a Wells notice from the SEC, some unsustainable meme coin advances and money kind of chasing that from a FOMO standpoint rather than investing in real projects. Solana even had some performance issues with their blockchain for the first time in, I believe, over a year. And then, of course, the tax day in the U.S., which, again, there's no real evidence to suggest that you know exactly which way this is going to push flows. But there's certainly a, you know, a one-time impact on the U.S. tax season. So when you put all those things together, that's a shift from a positive sentiment to a slightly negative sentiment. Again, I don't think any one of those by themselves was enough to push crypto over the edge. When you put them together, that's enough to change sentiment. And in my opinion, the Israel-Iran conflict and oil prices was, again, just a trigger that created some algo-driven selling, which then turned it into, okay, momentum trading is going to push this stuff and we're going to start focusing on the negatives rather than the positives.
Yeah, obviously a lot there and very well said. A lot of points talking about where these markets are. But I want to zoom in on something that you mentioned that I think is so important. And it's the topic of a recent blog post that you wrote. That's our two Satoshis. By the way, if you're not reading this blog, you should be. You can go and find it up on the ARKA website. But this is a blog post called Crypto versus the SEC. The title says it all. There are actually two parts of this. We'll unpack both of them. But let's focus on the regulatory component here, because you do a real deep dive on everything that's happening in the space. You present an overview, and then you drill down into all the individual cases, the precedent, a really impressive analysis here. Where are we right now with the regulatory environment for digital assets in the United States?
Sure. I think the regulatory overhang is definitely real. And when we talk to investors all over the world, and we have a nice, business development and IR team, in addition to our portfolio team here at ARKA, where we're constantly traveling and talking to investors. Over the course of 7 years now doing this, there's always been some constants with regard to the pushback we get on crypto, and there's always been some new things. Two of the constants were always, how do you value this, and regulation. The regulation issues with investors was incredibly high after 2022. To the point where it was just a non-starter with a lot of people. And that veil was lifted almost immediately when BlackRock announced that they were going to enter the Bitcoin ETF space. And it was unbelievable, just like night and day, where investors could no longer use that as an excuse. They basically said, okay, if BlackRock's involved, then we're not able to use this as an excuse anymore. But it wasn't just BlackRock getting involved, or maybe it was the spark, but you started to see a real pushback from companies and projects in this space who were for the first time willing to take the SEC on, head on. For example, you had, Ripple Labs versus the SEC, and you had the U.S. District Judge Torres basically saying that Ripple did not violate federal securities law by selling its Ripple tokens. That was sort of unique to just Ripple, but it definitely had a ripple effect on the next wave of SEC fights, which was Grayscale winning a court order against the SEC, in which the SEC was deemed as being arbitrary and capricious, which many believe was actually the final straw in allowing the Bitcoin ETFs to be approved. Then the SEC got a big win versus Coinbase, but the Coinbase wallet itself had a triumph over the SEC allegations, which was a giant win for DeFi, basically, which led to Uniswap now feeling more comfortable turning on their fee switch. Now you have ConsenSys joining the fight. The new wave, which I had never seen before in my career, is usually if you get issued a Wells notice from the SEC, you don't tell anybody, you're kind of quiet about it. Now it's like, hey, we got a Wells notice over here. We want to let everyone know we got a Wells notice, and we're going to fight it.
Let me read this. This is a quote right from the newsletter where you're quoting Joe Lubin, because I think it gives a sense of the temperature, at least as it's perceived right now by the founders in the space. I want to read this. This is, again, Joe Lubin from ConsenSys. Quote, we took this step for two very basic reasons. One, the SEC should not be allowed to arbitrarily expand its jurisdiction to include regulating the future of the internet. And two, the SEC's reckless approach in bringing chaos to developers, market participants, institutions, and nations who are building or are already managing critical systems running on Ethereum, the world's largest platform for decentralized applications. I think the one thing that's notable about this is, and this is the point that you were making, if you've spent time in the traditional finance space, you do not see CEOs of large investment banks publishing blog posts that sound like this and taking action against SEC. It's just something that's not done. So it is interesting when we talk about the temperature in this space, the way the space is being perceived. It's a pretty extraordinary moment.
It is. It's extraordinary. I mean, I've been in this industry or in finance industry now for almost 25 years. I didn't know the SEC commissioner names until recently. It wasn't something that you cared about. I mean, you feared the SEC from a respect standpoint. You feared them from a law abiding standpoint. You certainly listened to your compliance officers and made sure that you followed the law, but you didn't care who was actually in the seat. You didn't think about them in any meaningful way. You certainly didn't challenge them in this open way, which is, again, right. It's a continuation from BlackRock getting involved to these little recent minor wins. And you can see, again, this sort of ripple effect of, oh, like, we're going to fight this and we have a chance of really winning. And, a hat tip to all the larger, well-capitalized firms in crypto out there who not only have the willingness, but also the means to be able to fight this on behalf of the industry. I actually had we were lucky enough to have a meeting with Hester Peirce recently. I think it was at the end of last year, maybe beginning of this year. And one of the things—
Hester Peirce, of course, for people who don't know, is an SEC commissioner who's been very pro-crypto and has been critical of some of her colleagues in the SEC in regard to their handling of crypto regulation.
For sure. And we had a great meeting with her. And the one thing that stood out is she mentioned the reputational damage the SEC is taking right now, not just from crypto, but across the financial industry, in the sense that, again, the SEC would probably be better off if nobody talks about them, certainly would be better off than everybody talking about them, and is certainly in a negative way. And that's real problems, right? When you think about any sort of revolutions in the world or any sort of David versus Goliath type stories, that's what it starts with. It starts with, hey, these guys are overstepping their bounds. Maybe we didn't really know about them before, but now we do. And then there's a cohort of people who are just like fed up with it and really fight back. And again, this is not broad based against the SEC or any particular actions. We're simply pointing out that there is a cohort now of businesses that are well capitalized and have the means to push things forward where you're going to have real clarity coming to this industry, which you know, every project founder, every investor, every intermediary in this industry has been dying for. It's kind of like, when I say, I didn't even know the SEC commissioner's names years ago. I mean, it's kind of like a good ref or a good umpire, right? It's probably not great for anyone when they become the story. So, we'll see if some of these actions have big sweeping changes to the actual law, as well as, again, just a massive shift from this sentiment overhang to now a positive sentiment.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Well, it is interesting. You know, when you cover the story, you have to try and remain neutral about it, but it's just an extraordinary moment. Something that we've just, if you're new to this space, if you're new to financial services, if you're new to following a regulatory action, for example, this is just very unusual. This isn't something that you see. Jamie Dimon does not publish blog posts like this.
I mean, you saw it this week as well, when Robinhood got the Wells notice. I mean, barely even a blip. Nobody cared, right? A Wells notice used to be a really big deal. If you got a Wells notice, it was like, oh my God, like something bad is happening. Robinhood gets a Wells notice. They immediately tell everyone, say, we're going to fight it. Coinbase jumps on and says, we got your back. And no, the stock barely moved. There was no ripple effect in the market. Like, that's incredibly different than what it used to be like if you had any interaction or call out from the SEC.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. The other thing that you write about that's really interesting that I think it would be great for our viewers to be able to listen in on is your view of the challenges in the space right now in terms of the potential misalignments between digital asset creators, founders on the one hand, and their investors on the other. This, I think, is really interesting, and you're sort of uniquely positioned to talk about this because of your prior life in investment banking.
Yeah, I mean, I started my career as an investment banking capital markets employee at Lehman Brothers and spent a lot of time with new issues and M&A from the fixed income and the equity markets. So I definitely, have seen the way it's historically done in traditional markets versus where we are today. And not to pile on the SEC stuff here, but I mean, that is definitely part of why and how new issues in the token market are being delivered the way they are, because the SEC has so many lawyers and project founders and exchanges living in fear in terms of how to actually issue and list a token. But that being said, there's still things that are, in my opinion, just being done completely wrong. Not just different, but flat out wrong. Because there's just, hundreds of years of evidence of how to do it right in the debt and equity market versus what we're doing in tokens.
And you're talking about now the actual structure of the tokens and the way that the relationships with the investors, not the regulatory.
Correct. Right. I'm talking about the structure of the tokens, but also just the listing process. So to back up for a second, right? We had 2017, we had ICOs. ICOs was basically, we're just going to spin up a website, say, we're going to issue this token and anybody can participate, retail or accredited investor. You'll get your tokens and we'll see what happens, right? Ethereum's a best example of that. Ethereum, ran one of the more successful ICOs of just, you can turn in your Bitcoin for some Ethereum. And as a result, you had very early investors and users who were aligned properly, right? One of the things that drew me to crypto was that In my opinion, crypto is the greatest capital formation and customer bootstrapping mechanism that we've ever seen, because it fully aligns your shareholders or your token holders with your customers, right? If you're an early power user of a network or of a project, and you also get compensated for being early and for helping to bootstrap the growth, then you become a power user for life. You become an evangelist for life. You become exactly that sticky user that a project is looking for, right? The antithesis to that is something like, imagine if you were the first ever Amazon Prime member and you were crucial to getting Amazon Prime off the ground, but you still pay the exact same amount in annual Amazon Prime fees as everyone else. You didn't get any Amazon shares. You got no benefit from being somebody who pushed that together. Or you can go any further, right? You can go to Reddit and look at that. You can go to, you know, McDonald's and look at the misalignment between the customers of McDonald's versus the shareholders, right? I think I saw a Venn diagram once where it was basically like 99.9% of shareholders of McDonald's don't actually shop there. Right. So we've always had these misalignment, and crypto, in my opinion, was bringing that back. And the ICOs were a big part of that. You look at some of the early success stories, and there's no doubt in my mind that a lot of their success is because that early users were getting compensated for being early, were being encouraged to be power users, and were being encouraged to be evangelists. You fast forward to where we are now. And of course, everyone's terrified of selling tokens, especially in the US and certainly to retail, that we've come to this backwards way of, hey, we're only going to sell tokens in private rounds to venture funds. And then eventually we might airdrop the token to you and list it on an exchange. And while I don't think that was bad in spirit, but what's happening now is you're kind of turning into the equity markets where, you know, nobody's in a rush to IPO anymore. You can stay private as long as you can. The same thing is sort of happening in the digital asset world now, where it's let's just keep marking up these private rounds because these venture funds have unlimited money and they just want to continue to buy and support the project until they actually list the token, which gets listed artificially high and goes straight down. And then all of a sudden the support is gone. And if you look at the new issues that have been listed on Coinbase or on Binance specifically, they're all going straight down. And to clarify what I mean by this is there's a couple of different participants in the new issue process, right? First is the founders or the project owners who come up with the token and the tokenomics and the schedule of who's going to get what and vesting schedules and all that. You obviously have some consultants in there who, in my opinion, are giving terrible advice, but consultants who are helping these projects design the tokens. Then you have the exchanges who list them for you. Then you have the market makers who are basically being gifted tokens by the project and are in charge of sort of ensuring liquidity. And then, of course, you have the venture investors and then the new investors who come in and buy this stuff on exchanges. What's missing there is the investment bank or the middleman who actually is in charge of figuring out what is the clearing price. When you look at investment banking, when you see an IPO or a bond deal, there is a long roadshow. There's a long process in terms of figuring out where is their demand? What price is there going to be demand at? Maybe there's independent research firms writing about it saying, hey, this stock should price at this valuation based on where other stocks are, or this bond should come at an 8% yield based on where comps are. There's all this thought and discussion that goes into where it prices. And then after it prices, the investment bank who brings it, the book runner, actually has to take risk in terms of making markets. And as a result, there's league tables. League tables are a celebration of, hey, how did that stock or bond trade in the first day, the first week, the first month? And they take a lot of pride in saying, this stock or bond traded up for a month because we did a great job of pricing it. We did a great job of supporting it. None of that's happening in crypto. What happens is the VCs get their private valuations. The market makers get free tokens and take no risk. The founders take no risk. The exchanges take no risk. They spit it out there at some arbitrary price with no thought. And then it goes straight down, and it makes absolutely no sense. And there are better ways to do this.
It's so interesting. I mean, it's an absolute clinic on the way that banking takes place. It's also interesting because, you know, in many ways, maybe the crypto utopian view was that we were going to have decentralized markets, disintermediated from investment banks, and somehow we were magically going to arrive at accurate and fair price discovery. It sounds like what you're saying is that's not happening.
It's not at all. And look, I believe in the invisible hand, right? I think the price of an asset will probably get to the same place regardless of how it gets there. The difference is the future price is very much determined by the path that it takes. Meaning, let's take a token that the world thinks is worth, let's just say it should trade at $30, okay? And let's say there's private investments that push this thing up to $60 in the private rounds. And then they're the venture investors who are marking it at 60 because that's the last round are whispering to the market makers and the exchanges, you got to list this at 80 or 90 or 100 because then it's a markup from where we last listed it. But ultimately, it's going to get to 30 anyway. Well, all you're doing by listing it artificially high is you're basically incentivizing everybody who got early to sell it as fast as you can down to that 30 price. Now, let's take the opposite. Let's say that everybody knows it's worth 30, even though the last round was at 60. Let's say we list it at 10 and we give people a chance to buy it before it goes to 30 and it goes up 300%. Well, again, in my opinion, it's getting to 30 anyway. But the difference is in the first scenario, everybody's incentivized to sell. The market makers know it's going straight down, but they don't care because they're not taking risk. It's the founders who are giving them the tokens for free. The exchanges don't care because they're not taking any risk. And it just goes down to 30 and everyone's pissed off. Nobody made any money on it. And everyone just forgets about this project. And for the next 5 years, it just languishes. In the flip side, yeah, maybe the founders and the early investors give up a little bit of money because you price it at 10 bucks. But now you're giving people access to it at a more fair price and giving them a chance to make money, giving them a chance to be evangelists and power users that actually care about it. Maybe the venture firms that were going to be sellers at 90, instead of being sellers at 10, they actually become buyers at 10. They're like, you know what? We were going to sell it, but since it's so much lower than we last bought it, we're actually going to buy it and support it more. You get to the same place, but the path function matters. And there's a reason league tables exist. There's a reason investment banks care about the aftermarket performance because it matters. It changes sentiment. It changes outlook. You know, look at Facebook IPO back in whenever that was, 2011 or 2012, right? It was just an absolute terribly run process by Morgan Stanley et al. It came at 40. It immediately went down to 20. It took 2 years to get it back to where it should have been. And then ultimately it went up to 300 or wherever it went, right? That same thing could have been listed at 5 or 10, and it might have gotten to 300 or 400 even faster because you actually created this less negative environment and actually allowed people besides the early venture investors to make money. So, you know, as a call out to Binance and Coinbase and to the market makers and to the consultants and to the VCs and to the founders, there is a better way to do this and stop acting like it's the status quo just because everybody's doing
it. Jeff, for people who may be hearing about this for the first time, who may be getting their first view really of the detailed perspective that you have on how these ICOs work, let me ask you this, bearing in mind the sketch you've just drawn for us, what is a retail person who's out there following this to do? What does it mean for them?
Sure. And I should probably throw a disclaimer on there that this is not investment advice. But I mean, look, the term do your own research is real, right? I mean, obviously, ultimately, it is up to you, buyer beware. You have to figure it out on your own. That being said, a lot of cases, there's no ability to do that. Right. Again, the exchanges, whether they like it or not, are the de facto investment banks. They're the ones listing it. They're the ones putting it out there, but they're not putting any research or any price targets or anything out there. Right. So the retail investor is flying a little bit blind in a lot of these cases. At a minimum, they should be pushing back with the exchanges. And at a minimum, they should be on crypto Twitter and asking more questions like, hey, does anyone have opinions on where this should price or what's fair value for this? Or what does the token unlock schedule look like? You know, what's the token generation event? How many of the tokens are immediately going to vest with these venture firms that they're going to dump right away? I mean, this information is out there. And granted, it's easier for a firm like Arca with 30 employees and, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of capital to sniff this stuff out and have a real opinion than it is for retail. But I can tell you, like, we haven't touched a single new token listing, and we have one of the larger liquid funds out there. We wouldn't touch one of these Coinbase or Binance new issue listings because they're just the process is so horribly run. So as a cautionary tale, at least, I wouldn't tell anybody not to buy something, but I would tell them that there's also often a lot more information out there that if you spend a little bit of time looking at, you'll realize that maybe it's not a fair game.
Jeff, what a powerful statement. Of course, as you point out, not investment advice. We're just here to have this conversation and to get these voices heard. Jeff, really incredible conversation here today. We've covered a lot of different ground from the macro backdrop to the technology to some of the challenges as you perceive them in the current listing and creation structure process. Final thoughts, key takeaways that you'd like to leave our listeners and our viewers with from this conversation.
Sure. I think, you know, the best advice or ideas I have right now is that this is a really powerful technology, right? Again, the package, the wrapper of blockchain and what it can mean for all these different sectors and industries is real, right? Again, from AI to banking and finance to, real world assets and gaming. This is powerful and it's really exciting. And even though there's a lot of fluff out there, the good stuff is really good. And the more we can talk in a way that actually educates the end investor and the end user, that actually helps separate some of the meme coins versus the real stuff, the better. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, again, we all saw what happened with meme stocks in 2021 and 2022 with things like AMC and Bed Bath & Beyond and GameStop. If that was the first thing that an equity investor saw, they'd probably say, I'm never going to invest in equities ever again. This is rigged. This is stupid. I couldn't touch this. But instead, because we had so many decades of other examples in the equity market of real companies, most people were able to compartmentalize that and say, you know what, that's kind of a sideshow. It's kind of weird. Go have your fun. But that doesn't represent the equity market. The same thing is true in the digital asset world, where there's always going to be some weird things. You know, maybe there's some, a couple of things of fraud here and there. Maybe there's meme coins here and there, but that's not representative of the industry. There's real building happening. There's real technology underpinning this. There's real differentiation between types of tokens and types of industries. And the more we can educate people to look beyond the soundbite and look beyond the thing that is up or down 1,000% or down 100% in a month, it would be almost impossible for any educated investor to actually look at this space in a real way and say, I'm not willing to invest in that. You might say there's pockets of it that you don't want to invest in it, but to broadly say you won't touch crypto or tokens is just baffling to me, honestly. As someone who has studied this now for 6 years, there is just so much positive and so much a real value here. It's incredible. It's incredible to me that so many people can dismiss it.
Well, it's interesting. You know, it reminds me almost of the 18th century, where you hear about this new form of innovation called the joint stock company. You look at some of the spectacular implosions, frauds, John Law, the Mississippi Company, the South Sea Bubble. I mean, history is rife with these examples of the innovation being used simultaneously as a conduit for fraud on the one hand, and as a more efficient way to allocate capital and distribute risk on the other. I mean, it's just such a fascinating metaphor when you talk about it that way.
Yeah, it really is. And also just the intellectual curiosity too. Again, like, if you're an investor in any way, shape or form, or an innovator, or just a highly educated person, I would think you would want to learn about this. It's just fascinating. It's new. It's interesting. There's so many different pockets that you can dive into. That's more important than anything right now, is just better educating. In fact, I fortunately spent some time with the folks at BlackRock a couple of weeks ago. And I just flat out, I just said, you know, this is how I would explain Ethereum if you're ever going to push an Ethereum ETF. And all I said was, forget talking about Ethereum as a supercomputer or a network or all these things you hear. It's the app store, right? Ethereum's the Apple app store. Solana's, Android, the competitor. When an app store first launches, it's a blank canvas. It has some value because of what it could be one day, but there's nothing actually happening until the apps are built inside of it. And then you get your banking apps and your gaming apps and your, payment apps. And all of a sudden there's a flourishing ecosystem and all these transactions and fees are happening. And effectively the app store becomes super valuable. That's all it is. And he looked at me, he's like, we're going to steal that. I hope you know, and hope you don't mind. I'm like, please, please do. Cause it's just a better, easier analogy than some of the stuff that's floating around out there. Shout out to Matt Hoogan at Bitwise, who I saw probably had the best explanation of layer twos ever. He basically said, think about when you go to a bar, would it be super efficient for the bartender to every single time there was a transaction to make you pay with cash? No, you're going to bundle it all up and pay at the end. That's what a layer two does. I mean, these are easy analogies that help explain this space. And the more we educate, then the more willing people are, as users and investors, are going to be to dive into the real stuff and stop just paying attention to the fluff.
Hey, listen, talking of intellectual curiosity, if you want to hear more about this, go up to the ARKA website so you can check out That's Our Two Satoshis, which Jeff Dorman writes. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Always a pleasure. Always a great conversation.
Love being here, Ash. Thanks again for having us, and more power to you and all your guests and everything you're doing on the education front.
Thanks, Jeff. And I should say, talking about the intellectual curiosity front, we can finally reveal that Real Vision Crypto team is complete, and completed by none other than Wrecked Guy co-founders OVOSF Farouk and Michael Mando Anderson. Once a month, they will host a Drinks with OSF and Mando session exclusively for Real Vision Crypto members, where they'll cover everything from the macro landscape to meme coins to NFTs and more. The first one is happening this Friday, May 10 at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. And for 3 days only, we're discounting the price of joining Real Vision Crypto. So if you've missed the launch, now is the best time to join. Just go to realvision.com realvision.com/RVC. That's realvision.com/RVC to learn more. If you're already a Real Vision member, be sure to check your email. Thank you all so much for watching and for listening to Real Vision Daily Briefing. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. See you then. Have a great afternoon, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. At Real Vision, we arm you with the expert knowledge, time-efficient tools, and a powerful network to help you succeed on your financial journey. Get a taste of financial freedom with our free offer at realvision.com/free.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsynads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.